Radio EcoShock.
I received an invitation to read a book newly coming out for English readers. The title is The Anthropocene, The Human Era, and How It Shapes Our Planet. Little did I know how deep and sometimes disturbing this adventure into ideas would become. The author is Christian Schwagerl. He's been one of the best environmental journalists in Berlin for 25 years. Christian holds a Master of Science degree himself. When the first German version of this book was published as Mensch sein Zeit, or The Age of Humans, the head of the United Nations Environment Program, Achim Steiner, spoke at the book launch. From Berlin, Christian Schwagerl, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on the program.
Well, of course, we must start with the definition of what the word Anthropocene means. That can take a couple of chapters, I know, but would you give us an introduction to its meaning?
The Anthropocene is a geological concept. It reflects how much we humans affect the planet, how much we are changing it. And I'm not just talking about climate. I'm talking about the way humans change the surface of the Earth, change the soils, change the course water runs, change the evolution of animals and plants, changes the biodiversity. So Anthropocene basically means that we humans have become the dominant force of change on Earth, and that our actions actually are not just, we're not just kind of scratching the surface of the Earth. We are changing the Earth system deeply. We are changing it fast, and we are changing it for a long time. So what we do now will be visible in the geological record for a long time. And that's why a Nobel laureate, Paul Crutzen, came up with this word to say, look, it's the age of humans in a sense that we are changing the geology, the biology, the chemistry of Earth for a long future. And in the future, it will be able to look back and see what we have done.
Yes, we can't really understand the Anthropocene or the movement developing around it without knowing a little bit about this famous scientist, Paul Crutzen. You've been involved with him over the years. How would you introduce Paul to our audience?
Yeah, Paul is a scientist who's not just interested in science. He's a great scientist. He started the research on the CFCs, those substances that are dangerous for the ozone layer. And he saw already in the early 70s that there are substances that are dangerous for the layer that protects the Earth from ultraviolet radiation. And he kind of triggered the research that led to the discovery of the ozone hole and to the political efforts to then ban the dangerous substances. And so Paul actually was involved also in the political campaign in order to ban these dangerous substances. So he's a man with a sort of broad horizon, and this ozone experience kind of made him think, you know, what else are we doing and what else might happen? So he kept being concerned, and he kept making these lists of things humans do with Earth and how we are changing basically the metabolism of Earth, the workings of the Earth system. And that's why in the year 2000, it was more or less, as he describes it, a spontaneous idea in a meeting in Mexico, a scientific meeting. People were talking of the Holocene, and that's, you know, in the school books you learn we are living in the Holocene. That's the geological epoch that has started roughly 11,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age. And that's what pupils learn today at school. You know, we live in the Holocene. And these scientists were talking about the Holocene. And in this meeting in the year 2000, Paul Crutzen stood up and said, you know, no, look, no, we are not living in the Holocene anymore. We live in the Anthropocene, the age of humans, or the epoch of humans. And as he describes it, people were stunned because this word really is very strong. The new age of humans, that's the literal meaning of it is. And so, you know, he's now very excited. He's already almost 81 years old, and he's very excited now that this idea is kind of going viral at the moment.
Our listeners are environmentally aware people, Christian, and some are already thinking that naming an age after ourselves is just another example of our focus on everything human or anthropocentrism. How do you answer that?
Yeah, I think that's a very important concern. And I think it's important to actually avoid this sort of interpretation. And Paul Crutzen is kind of terrified by the idea that people might say, oh, great, it's the age of humans. Now we can do everything. You know, it's our age. It's the age of kind of engineering everything and of kind of human dominion over Earth. And that's not his way of thinking. You could actually argue that there's this danger that this word kind of makes us become even more anthropocentric. But my experience is different, because when you start realizing how much we do, and that's what the Anthropocene word captures, you know, how much happens on so many levels. And when you compare it with how much of it we understand, think about climate change or soil erosion or biodiversity loss. And if you compare it with how many of these changes have positive outcomes for ourselves, then you start realizing that it would be the most horrible idea to make the Anthropocene something anthropocentric, although the two words sound so similar. And my approach is that it's actually the total opposite, that through realizing how much we change, how much we interwoven we are with the Earth system, we come to realize that this is an age where we kind of find out how much we are part of nature. So this Anthropocene idea in a way makes us part of nature, something we have avoided in Western civilization. We've always tried to kind of put us above nature or outside nature and look at our economy. It extracts from nature, but it doesn't give any value to nature itself, to like untouched nature, to wilderness, to biodiversity. It's all zero value given to it. And so it's kind of blind to nature, and it always, our system, Western thinking, always tries to put us above nature. And the Anthropocene idea kind of roots us back into Earth geology and back into nature. And if you come out anthropocentric out of this process, I think something has gone terribly wrong. And my feeling is that the Anthropocene idea will actually make us less anthropocentric.
Good. Well, let's talk about the argument for naming a new age. You say humans have affected geology, chemistry, and biology. Why don't we just start with geology? Surely we can't have that much effect on rivers and rocks and the structure of the Earth?
Yeah, once you start looking into this, and I'm a biologist, so I was mainly concerned also in my writing with like things like biodiversity. But when you start looking at the actual geology of Earth, you start discovering that humans have already created something like 5 million mines on the planet, you know, spots where we have started to dig tunnels or create large open pits. Mountaintop mining is a very strong geological intervention. Think about cities, for example. I mean, you don't always have to think about the very negative things. Cities themselves are a geological thing. They are made of stone that has been brought from very different parts of the world in many cases, and glass and other synthetic materials. So they will form in the future when a geologist, say in a million years, a hypothetical geologist will look back, he will find a very funny layer of things of mixed stone that was a city. Other examples are, I mean, if you look at aluminium, like the isolated aluminium we use in the aluminium foils, there's so much aluminium extracted from the earth now and purified that you could cover the whole United States into aluminium foil. Or think about plastic. Plastic can actually become something like a stone. It kind of gets fossilized. And there's now enough plastic in the oceans and so on that you could wrap the whole earth in cling film, which is also amazing. Think about the levels of like carbon dioxide that will remain in stones or in the ice if there is anything left on a warming planet in the future. That is also a sort of geological thing. Think about the radionuclides from the atomic tests and the actual bombs that were dropped. So these are artificial elements that will stay in the geological records for a very long time. Think about all the canals we have made, changing the course of water, and all of these things. If you, the list is really long, and when you add up the list, you come to a point where really we are changing geology to such an extent that future geologists will see our imprint. We are we are creating a geological record that will have a human imprint on it.
You had a couple of really fun ideas there. I think if we wrapped the world in plastic wrap, maybe it would keep longer, and it certainly would be fun to see America covered in tinfoil, even if only for a day. Well, has any official scientific body agreed to the Anthropocene, or will they do so soon?
Yeah, well, I think it's really important and good you're mentioning this. This comes from science. It's on the one side, it stays a scientific hypothesis. So there is a formal institution that kind of the people that are, you could call them the guardians of Earth time. So Earth is, what, 4.6 billion years old, and these people have the job to divide this history up into, like, chapters and subchapters and paragraphs and sentences. So you could kind of make it accessible for our understanding. So that's where you have the Cretaceous or the Devonian or the Jurassic, so these large kind of chapters of Earth history. And there's an international scientific body called the International Commission on Stratigraphy, who is kind of in charge of keeping Earth time and dividing it up. And this group has now set up a working group. It's called the Anthropocene Working Group, to actually look into the evidence. So to see whether what is captured by the word Anthropocene has a scientific reality. And that is a very strict process. There are strict scientific geological criteria that have to be met. For example, you need a global signal that is kind of very different from what happened before. For example, when the dinosaurs died out, suddenly there were no dinosaur bones anymore in the geological record. So you can basically draw a very good line there and say, okay, end of the dinosaur chapter, no bones anymore. Now, for example, today, you could say we now have billions of cattle that are slaughtered every year for our needs, and bones remain, and a lot of them are buried, or the chicken bones that get thrown away and end up in landfills. So in a future geological record, so 56 million years ago, you had suddenly the dinosaur bones went missing. But in the Anthropocene, the cattle and chicken bones, they come into the geological record. So these guys, they now make a kind of a long list again, or an analysis, whether geological criteria are met. And in 2016, so in 2 years' time, they want to come up with a first official vote. And the process is longer, but this will be a very important milestone. And the Anthropocene itself now inspires a lot of scientists to kind of reassess their work and do more about researching human-caused changes. It's one thing, for example, that the biological research stations, they're all kind of concentrated in the remaining wilderness areas, which is great. I mean, they have to be there. But 75% of Earth's surface is now modified by humans, and there are far too few biological research stations that kind of really explore the human-made changes. So now there's kind of this reassessment that we really have to look into this new nature, which we create on 75% of the planet's surface, which is modified, the agricultural deserts, for example, the monocultures and things like that.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. Christian Schwagerl, the further I travel into your book, The Anthropocene, The Human Era, and How It Shapes Our Planet, I become a little uneasy, and it starts with your arguments for optimism. You grew up being a nuclear target in Bavaria, and yet now you say no apocalypse. Why not?
Right. Well, I think that it's really important to have this sense of urgency. I mean, with climate change and biodiversity loss and many other problems, plastic pollution in the oceans, we see a lot of things are happening fast, and we really need to do something now. You know, not something. We need to do a lot. We need to go into systemic changes, I think, in the way our economies are run, our politics sets priorities, and other things. So I don't want to play down anything. The problem is, and I have been, you know, socialized in a very kind of environmentally conscious area in Bavaria, and in my job as a journalist, I have a lot to do with environmentalists, and I admire a lot of them for what they do. But often I come into this sort of doom way of thinking, oh my God, we are lost, you know, and the earth is already kind of beyond hope, and the apocalypse is nigh, the end is nigh. And this kind of doomsday thinking, I think, stops us from developing really kind of creative ideas for how the future might look like, and also positive stories of how we want the world to look like in the future. And we leave these positive stories to the, you know, techno commercial guys who are selling, who want us to shop us to death. And we're not kind of creating a counter narrative in a sense, because we say, well, you know, it's the apocalypse. Climate change will kill us all, and the planet will is doomed already. And I think in the environmental movement in particular, there's a great need for spreading hope and spreading kind of positive ideas of what people with an environmental consciousness and conscience want the world to be. And this apocalypse idea stops us from it. I mean, there's this famous saying by the Protestant reformer Martin Luther that if he knew the apocalypse was nigh and the world would end tomorrow, he would still plant an apple tree, right? One says that a lot here in Germany. I think it's wrong. I mean, if I knew the world would end tomorrow, I would not plant an apple tree. I would try and eat apple pie. So I think by saying the apocalypse is nigh, we are encouraging people actually to become even more short-term, to just have a big party and consume as much as they like, because, you know, it doesn't matter anyway. So we need to kind of go beyond that and say the problems are urgent, but we will have to live with them for a very long time. And our kids and grandchildren and all the other living beings we share the planet with, they will have to stick with what we are leaving them behind for a very long time, for the next, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, perhaps in some instances. Think about nuclear waste. So I think we, by creating this idea of a long future, we are actually increasing a sense of urgency and responsibility. And the apocalypse type thinking makes people kind of hopeless, perhaps passive, or even worse, kind of, you know, think, you know, now let's have this final party. And, you know, I don't think that's good.
Well, I'm going to ask you to explain your positive vision at the end of this interview, because I think that's a good way to wrap up. But first, I do have a couple of doubts about a couple of things you've written. For example, you say, even if climate change turns out to be worse than scientists at the IPCC fear, it will not lead to the end of the world or the collapse of civilization. This won't even come to pass if climate change, food crises, and cyber wars all occur simultaneously. Really, I mean, if the climate warms by 6 degrees or more in less than 200 years, as some scientists have suggested, you think civilization will still stand?
Yeah, well, it will be a very different civilization, and I'm not sure I would want to live in it or with it. It might be kind of, you know, military dictatorship that is really horrible, and it just kind of digging itself into the geology, perhaps, you know, people moving into the civilization, moving into caves. We have a very famous author here in Germany, Alfred Döblin, who kind of wrote a science fiction in the 1920s exactly about that, that, you know, a kind of techno-military dictatorship will move to the caves with, you know, high-tech civilization. So what I'm trying to say with this in the book is that we humans are very resilient. I mean, we're living from the polar areas to the tropics. We're living from the kind of along the seashores to the highest mountains. We are a very resilient species. And I'm not saying that our civilization, the way we live now, will persist. I'm just saying that a human civilization, most probably. I mean, I'm not a prophet. I can't really foretell the future. It's just what I'm trying to say is that there will not be a final curtain. You know, and often in these kind of climate change diagrams, you see that in 2050 or now 2100, and then there is this end. And what I'm trying to say is, no, there is no end. You know, it will continue. If we change the climate by like 6 degrees, you know, we will have to live with it. That's basically my main point. And I'm not saying it will not hugely change our civilization. I just think that humans will still be around for a very long time, and they will have to live with what we do now.
And then you have a chapter called Directing Evolution. And I ask myself, who is going to direct evolution? Will it be a cabal of multi-billionaires? I mean, democracy's almost dead here in North America. Who would direct it? Monsanto or?
Yeah, well, that's happening, and I don't like it. and I think that's really important to see that part of this Anthropocene that's happening is that humans gain the knowledge and also the power to really change organisms on a genetic level. We've been breeding animals for 10,000 years and changing plants for a long time, but now the methods to do that become more powerful. And that's why I think it's really important to have this democratic revolution to kind of reclaim evolution in a way so that not big corporations take it away from us, patent it, and then sell it back to us. I think that there needs to be, and I share your concerns about the crisis of democracy. But when we now enter a phase where we really design new organisms, perhaps we don't want to do this. This would be also a democratic decision. But we are changing organisms on so many levels globally that I think there needs to be a democratic approach to that as opposed to a very kind of narrow corporate process that makes just a few people rich and making the earth poorer. We need to see that it's not just about kind of clinging to old type nature. It's about how to design the process that creates new beings.
Well, as you write in your book, there has been a small debate from Andy Revkin in the New York Times to Elizabeth Colbert about whether that can be a good Anthropocene. You do wrap up your book with a personal vision of how things might not turn out so badly as many people think. Please take a minute or two to take us on a tour of how we might survive ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because if the Anthropocene as an idea would just be the sum of all environmental problems, I think then we would have to fight it. Then we'd have to say, we must fight to stay in the Holocene. But I think part of the Anthropocene is to become aware of this global responsibility and to act. And so I think it's very inspirational to act and to change things. So, for example, I think that our lifestyles are very important. The way we connect with nature are very important. So I'm not a person who thinks that there are technological solutions, but I think technology plays a good role. And part of my scenario is that we really learn to imitate nature in a positive way, to create like cars that are biodegradable and electronic gadgets that are biodegradable. So to kind of make the technosphere part of the biosphere in a positive sense. So I have examples of that in my book of, this is very kind of fictional, of course, but of like bionic whales that are set free in the ocean to feed on the plastic in the ocean and to digest it, basically. Another example I'm giving, and that is of a social movement, is that I think China will be the hotbed of the next environmental movement. You have pressing environmental problems there, the smogs and everything. And you have a longing for participation. And I think I'm hopeful that Asia will see the rise of a new environmental movement. A third area I would like to mention is the question how our economy works. And I know this is problematic, but I think as long as money is so important, I think we need to start attribute some monetary value to what is important. And that is like something like wilderness or biodiversity. And you could say this is the final commodification of everything, and I'm scared of that as well. But as long as the money system is so important, I think, and that's part of my scenario, that through that, societies need to learn to reappreciate the value that is offered to us by living systems, by living wilderness areas, or functioning harmonic biocultural landscapes that are rich in biodiversity. So I think we need to broaden the horizon of our economic system to the what's really valuable, and nature is a big part of that. So my scenario kind of describes the process of realizing all of this and ending up in an Anthropocene that deserves the word good.
The book, The Anthropocene, The Human Era and How It Shapes Our Planet, is available now from Synergetic Press at a very reasonable price of just $10 for the paperback. The electronic version is coming soon. You can find links to all this, including a YouTube presentation by Christian Schwagerl, in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. Christian, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
But we, who are all that are left of the old engineers and mechanics, have pledged ourselves to salvage the world. We have the airways, all that's left of them. We have the seas, and we have ideas in common. The Brotherhood of Efficiency. The Freemasonry of Science. We're the last trustees of civilization when everything else has failed.
I've been waiting for this.
Are we ready for tech nature and human creation of new life forms? Find more of my impressions on this book and links to the works discussed in this interview in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.